Session number 3970, wheel number 3.
Mr. Goldsmith, reel 3, you were just telling me about going out of the camp.
Yeah, going out of the camp down to the river being the Murrumbidgee, and the Murrumbidgee, while being one of the big rivers, isn't always very full of water. And my recollection is that it was sort of carved out of the landscape and pretty brown. A lot of trees had fallen into it, but still it made a pleasant change. In fact, talking about brown water, after heavy rains, I don't think the local system of purifying the water was what we have in London today, and the water on those occasions came out the tap more like brown water than the normal colour, although I don't think it did anybody any real harm. We still had at that time the old-fashioned tin plates that the army used. Whether it was this or the water, but I was at one point admitted to hospital with suspected appendicitis, but they didn't operate and put me on a milk diet, and thank goodness they cleared it up. There were quite a number of people who had to go into hospital who suffered with heart problems. I think it was more the atmosphere and the temperature, which went extremely high at times there, particularly in the sun, and also the sand blowing about didn't help. Also at one time, although I haven't got any very much recollection of it, the question arose of working an allotment. I think I used to go out with one soldier as an escort, but I don't think it was ever very successful. It was little distance from the camp. And of course the army barracks were outside, and I recall that the story got around one morning that we had at one time some very young soldiers there guarding, new recruits, and with a young officer, and they were due to go on embarkation leave, and something that could have never happened in the British Army. The story goes that the young soldiers went to the officer's tent at night, took down his pyjama trousers and used a tin of black boot polish on his backside to good effect. I would shudder to think what would have happened if that happened in the British Army. Then, after, I would have thought, 6 to 9 months, we were moved to Tatura, being a camp near Shepparton in Victoria. This had the great advantage of the climate being far more what one is used to in this country, although it was much warmer than we are used to, but the countryside is far greener. It was hilly, and it is near a fruit-growing area, and gives some idea. The camp was almost identical in design as were all internment camps in Australia.
While you were at Hay,
yes,
did you have any means of getting extra things that you wanted, whether they be food, cigarettes,
shoes? Certainly. No, I think we must have got army issue. If someone really ran out of clothing, I'm pretty certain of that, because I'm sure we didn't have any facilities to buy clothing. We had a canteen, and an excellently run canteen as it was, and in fact I have in my possession, through a chance, the records of Mr. Callier, that's the name, who ran the canteen, with balance sheets and records of inquiries, and also, amongst other things, submission to the government in Australia, to organizations the church and other voluntary bodies who were trying to help, and submissions to the British government. I have all that in my possession, and I believe the records are available with this wheel of...
How did you buy things from the canteen?
I think either money was sent out, or in my case, as I said, I had my post office saving bank book, and it was an ordinary money transaction. Although there was camp money produced. In fact, if we can stop the reel in a minute, I'll try and find some for you, or when we come to the end of the record, because I don't think we actually used cash. It was done that when one had money, it was put on a, call it a slate, and you were then able to use it, or you got camp money from the office and used that. But I don't think actual cash was used, for the simple reason is, as a safety precaution, I should imagine, that people couldn't accumulate too much money and use it if they tried to escape. Although I think I'm pretty certain that no escape attempt was made at any time.
Could you acquire money if you wanted it by, say, working for someone else?
I would have thought if somebody wanted something done and was too lazy himself, yes, I would have thought so, but I don't remember much of that. As far as the canteen is concerned, I don't think anybody would have wanted to buy additional food as such. I'd be very surprised. I think the canteen really stocked things like cigarettes and other smoking material, chocolates and sweets and writing material and perhaps even painting material or anything like that, anything that... But I wouldn't have thought that they produced, that they had stock of food or anything like that. So we moved to Tatura, and life there was roughly along the same line.
You said that the accommodation was similar.
Yes.
Did you do anything to alter your accommodation?
Very
less Spartan.
Very little. I don't think so. I think some people may have done a bit of painting or hung up pictures if they got hold of anything. I mean, for instance, we got newspapers. There again, I think we got them 2 or 3 days later, but we got newspapers and we knew what was going on in the world, however inadequately. No, I don't think any great attempt was made. Now, either in Tatura or the next camp we moved on to, 2 or 3 months later in... what is it?
Bamira,
that's right, in South Australia, which is... which is on the Murray River and in the grape growing area of South Australia, where they produce raisins and currants. And I remember that there again it was very warm, and they had a very nice reservoir there with huge palms. And talking about reservoirs, there was also a very large reservoir near Tatura. And how we got there, I don't know. But it was either there or at Bramira where there were huge, when I say huge, I mean huge, flocks of black swan. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them. And it is a fantastic sight. And so there we are. Anyway, of course, all the time, efforts were being made to get us released. All this is documented, and these efforts were made both by organizations and by individuals, including my mother's cousin, who wrote to the Home Office, etc.
He was in fact a serving officer in the British Army.
He was in fact a lieutenant in the British Army, in the Pay Corps, and he had been a lieutenant, acting captain in the First World War, so he was an old soldier.
Do you suppose that made any difference?
I don't think so for 1 minute, no. I don't think it made any difference, because I certainly had no preferential treatment in any way through that. And eventually... the British government, in connection with the Australian government, decided to give an opportunity to the internees to join the army. In fact, the British Army had already, in September 1939, formed Pioneer Corps companies out of Jewish refugees who had been given a temporary shelter, one can best describe it, at the Kitchener Camp in Sandwich, in Kent. The purpose of this camp was to get people out of Germany as soon as possible, particularly out of concentration camps, who had a definite promise of a entry visa to the United States. And the British government, quite rightly and very usefully, gave them shelter until that came through. Now, on the outbreak of war, three companies of 250 men each were formed, 69, 74th, and 93A Company Pioneer Corps, which consisted, apart from the officers at that time, the WOs and half the sergeants, entirely of what were technically enemy aliens. And the idea was, and some others were formed later, and the idea was by the British and the Australian government to give us the opportunity either to volunteer to join the Pioneer Corps in England or join a similar unit in Australia. And, of course, all this took, from our point of view, a tremendous amount of time because all this had to go backwards and forwards to England and the Australian government. And so eventually we were given the opportunity to volunteer either for the British Army or the Australian Army. And having formed an attachment to my mother's cousin's daughter, I decided it was better if I came home. So eventually, the next thing that happened was, of course, that the Japanese war broke out. And I cannot remember whether we already had left the camp on our journey back home or whether the outbreak of war happened while we were in the transit camp. But what happened was that I remember leaving Bamira on the local train. Now, the local passenger train was a local, in inverted commas. It consisted of one engine, one coach, and the necessary number of goods trucks attached. And at each station, one stopped and pushed one off and put another one on, etc. And eventually, we got to Murray Bridge, where we were to join the Transcontinental Express. And I suppose for my inefficiency in these matters, I was put in charge of the luggage. We were told that the luggage van was at one end, which we had to store our luggage in, and our compartment was right at the other end. And now the Transcontinental Express is A, a very long train, and B, has got some very long coaches. So we had to get on with it and then run to the other end and get on the train to Melbourne, and found out the next morning when we got there that the Prime Minister of Australia had been on the train and that we duly kept waiting by some internees being too slow in packing their luggage. Anyway, in Melbourne we were transshipped and went to, I believe the border town is called Albany, between Victoria and New South Wales, and at that time it was still necessary to transship trains because the gauges in Victoria and New South Wales of the railway are different. And so we joined the train and eventually arrived in the suburb of Liverpool in Sydney for awaiting our transportation to back home to England.
What was your English family's reaction when you were taken away?
What reaction? Well, my then girlfriend, my now wife, I believe walked the whole way from Worthing to Rustington along the beach going looking for me and didn't find me. What was their reaction? Well, there was nothing they could do about it. That was the government action. All that could be done was, like a lot of other organizations did, make representations to make it clear that it was a foolish act to intern refugees who, whilst technically in the eyes of the law were enemy aliens, were certainly not in the spirit enemy at all, but on the contrary would use every effort to fight the common enemy, perhaps more so than had far more interest in fighting a common enemy than many people in this country. I think this is an important element. This is why 4,000 Jewish refugees, in fact, joined up in 15 companies, and many of them were later asked to volunteer for other branches of the fighting services and rose to the rank of officers. In fact, the highest that I'm aware of is a lieutenant colonel, who was still, although he held the King's Commission, was still technically an enemy alien at the time. You see. So I was in fact interviewed myself twice to ask to join the commandos later on in 43 or thereabouts, and in both instances my answer was the same, that I had volunteered to join the army. I had come back all the way from Australia. I was in the army, and if they ordered me to go anywhere, I would go. But if they asked me to volunteer, the answer was no. Once was sufficient.
How frequently were you able to write to the English part of your family?
We were given actual letter sheets, which I still have, all of those that survived, or rather my wife has, although we haven't looked at them for many years. They were on very glossy paper, and they were lined. And I think you were allowed to write 25 lines on them, if I remember correctly. And I think they must have been one per week or thereabouts. And I don't think there was any restriction on incoming post. I don't think so. And I think it must have been possible afterwards also to send parcels, because I think some people got parcels. But you must realize that all the post went by surface mail, and therefore under those circumstances would normally take around about 2 months either way. So a actual communication was pretty impossible, that when you thought about it, that by the time you got an answer 4 months later, it was pretty well out of date. And then with wartime restrictions on what you could write, there was very little. There was, however, a service provided through the refugee organizations, both in Australia and in this country, that short messages of "I'm well, how are you" sort of type were communicated by airmail as a bulk communication and then sent out to the various recipients. I think we got copies of them somewhere, aren't they? Somewhere upstairs. Or you actually had copies of them. So as far as communications were concerned, and then of course the odd letters would get lost through enemy action, but I can't remember how often that happened. But that I think is all. There were no other communications apart from newspapers which we got locally.
Did you try to write to your parents?
No, I did not, because I might have done early on in the war, and I got an idea that one or two letters came through at the beginning of the war, didn't they? Because the actual family tree information came pretty late, right? I think we can find the date of that, but I don't think it's important, but I'm pretty sure that came through during the war. But as I say, all that letter traffic came through, it wasn't Red Cross as such, I think it came through Lisbon. So where would you like to go from there?
How much did you know about the efforts that were being made on your behalf to get you out?
Oh, I think that we knew a fair amount, allowing for the delay, because there were communication through the refugee committees in Australia through the Jewish community, and also of course with the delay in the communication from home, I think the letters must have contained information on that, because that was public knowledge, you see. I mean, representations were made in Parliament and they were reported in the, certainly in the Jewish press, if not in the wider press. So, oh yes, this was all, that was common knowledge, because you see, I think once one can understand the panic measure that the government took on the 10th of May, under the circumstances that prevailed at that time, I think very soon afterwards they began to realize that it was a panic measure and was fairly unnecessary, and whilst the governments act slowly, it took a long time to reverse the situation, because I think the releases from English internment camps took place pretty soon, must have started pretty soon after we left. I think by the time August and September came around, I think you must know more about this, I think quite a number of people were already being released from the Isle of Man and perhaps even from Haydn.
There are a number of categories under which people could be released, and depending on how well one fitted into these.
Quite.
Some people were out in, say, 3 months. Other people were on the Isle of Man for a year and a half.
Yes, well, you see, 3 months ties in with what I said. You see, if they were interned in June, 3 months brings them into August, so by September, too, but there were already quite a number released, you see. So,
if you hadn't gone to Australia, you probably would have been free much sooner.
Yes, so I would have been in the army much sooner, and I wouldn't have seen Australia.
But
so it didn't do me, it didn't, as it all turned out in the end, it didn't do me any harm.
That's private communication. What about public? How much did you know about what was happening in the war?
Well, we knew what was happening in the war simply by getting a supply of newspapers. They may have been a day or two old. We got Australian newspapers, and we knew what was going on in the world. That's what I mean, as much, I mean, we didn't have any wirelesses, of course, and I shouldn't imagine that the news bulletins at that time carried much more information than the newspapers did because of wartime censorship, so I don't think we missed very much as far as news was concerned.
Was the war situation something that was discussed very much?
Oh, yes, yes, I think that was, because, well, let's put it this way, with the type of person of high intellectual that you had there, of course, and with the background of having been born in the country, a great deal of interest was taken in the war situation. Oh yes, there's no question about that.
Can you tell me about the backgrounds of people in camp?
Oh, not really, because
I'm sure it's a cross-section of society, but what does that mean?
It doesn't mean anything. It only means it is not a background. No, it's not a cross section of society. It is a cross section of the Jewish community as it existed in Germany. I think that's a fairer comment, right? With other words, with a very high proportion of professional and intellectual people, and with a very small proportion, or much smaller proportion than what one would find normal, of people who earn their living with their hands instead of with their brains. Let's put it that way.
How did that make you feel, you being in that smaller proportion then as a gardener?
It didn't worry me the slightest bit. It has never worried me. I have never worried about being in company of people who either have better qualification than I have, or have long strings of letters behind their name, or who hold this or that position, because I have always treated people on their ability and how they have acted, rather than what they're qualified to be. And perhaps being thrown into such a particular group of people and live with them practically exclusively, both in internment and in the army, because after all the assortment was practically the same in the A Pioneer Corps companies. And whilst on perhaps a technical matters. I mean, I couldn't keep up with an accountant on technical bookkeeping, and I can't keep up with a lawyer on technical law, and I can't keep up with a chemist on chemistry above a certain level. I mean, I learned a small amount of chemistry for the purpose of fertilizers in horticultural, but that's where my ability stops in it. But in general terms and general knowledge, it has never worried me.
Whether it worries you or not, I was imagining it could mean that the camp would be society as a whole, since you couldn't leave it and there were no people coming
quite.
In. So it might have certain groups and factions and a hierarchy within itself.
Yes, it had groups and a hierarchy, because we had camp leaders, we had hut leaders, all that sort of thing. But it didn't worry me. They weren't able to do my job properly, so let them get on with theirs. Never worried me. Never worries me today either.
Did they do theirs properly?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yes. You see, the ability was there.
You said it was a cross-section of the Jewish population in Germany at that time.
Yes.
You surely weren't all Jewish. Or had they segregated the camps?
Well, I would say that the people who were interned in those two camps, 7 and 8, were at least 95% Jewish. Whether they were all considered themselves religious Jews, i.e. that they belonged to a synagogue of whatever a degree of religion, I wouldn't like to say, but they were certainly Jewish, or Jewish by birth. You see, and this is the point.
You said you didn't think there were any A category internees with you.
Yeah.
Were there any people whom one would have reason to think ought to be interned? Any suspicious internees?
What, in amongst those two camps? What do you mean, who should have remained intern? I don't know. I wouldn't like to say that today. I have no idea. Certainly, I wouldn't have thought that any of the B or C categories would have given any cause for a worry to the country from a security point of view. A is an entirely different matter, because A included some straightforward German non-Jewish people who lived in this country, and whilst quite likely a lot of them would not have been a security danger, I'm quite sure there, to a very large extent, their sympathy lay with Germany. So, I mean, that's the answer. So, of course, therefore, they are security risks.
Though the justification for interning everyone was national security, presumably.
Well, that's right.